gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour and on irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, we're getting through February and into the third week of classes here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. And our public events programming is back in full swing. On Thursday night, we had the pleasure of hosting Colm Tobin, and he spoke about his newest novel, Nora Webster, and I'll be sharing. Last night, we had a fantastic Blarney Star concert. We had Ivan Goff and Cleek Sheary perform. Well done, as usual, to Don Mead on coordinating another fine concert in the Blarney Star concert series. That evening, yesterday evening, started actually with an open house for our MA program. Just to remind anyone who's interested in a Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies, our priority deadline is March 1st, although we will accept applications after that date. We do accept rolling admissions. I have a rather artsy program in store this week. I've two very interesting guests here on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour this morning. I'm going to start off by talking to a very accomplished and impressive actor called Craig MacArthur. And Craig is coming in to have a chat to me about his role in Enda Walsh's play Mr. Man. He and the production team are gearing up for a run at Boulder Arts Week, which is coming up in late March. So while he was in town, Craig has taken time out of his schedule to come in and have a chat to us about the process of playing really the only actor on stage in this very interesting Enda Walsh play. So I'm looking forward to sharing that chat with you. He is a really nice guy, and you don't have to spend too much time with him to realise that he's a very talented actor. And hopefully it's in the pipeline. This production of Mr. Man will come to the New York area in the not-too-distant future. My second guest today is somebody I'm delighted to finally meet. The renowned Irish composer Frank Corcoran is in town. He is performing tomorrow as part of the Midwinter Fest, which will take place at Christ and St. Stephen's Church. That's at 120 West 69th Street between Broadway and Columbus. It's a free concert at 3 p.m. There's free admission, so there is no excuse whatsoever to miss out. So I'm going to have a chat to Frank. He has long resided in Germany and more recently in Italy. And just to have a chat to somebody with his range of references in terms of his sense of Irishness and to hear him talking about the life of a composer, it's really fascinating. It's a real education to engage with somebody about the pursuit of composing. It's a fascinating art form. Now, before I move on to my conversations, I just want to remind you that on Thursday night at 7 p.m., we're very excited to welcome Dr. Maureen O'Rourke Murphy. Maureen Murphy is well known in the community, an impressive scholar who has another fine book out. This is on A. Smith Nicholson, the very interesting American writer and person who basically comments on Ireland during the famine. So Maureen is launching her new installment on this research at Glucksman Ireland House. That's on Thursday, February 19th at 7 p.m. So there are still some spaces available. So do shoot off an email to ireland.house@nyu.edu if you're interested in attending this event. It promises to be a great night. So I hope you enjoy this program, folks. So sit back and relax. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to sit down with a gentleman who is going to tell us about an exciting project he's been working on for the last few months and about the next stage in terms of the journey of this project. I'm sitting here with Craig MacArthur. And Craig has played in recent months and is getting ready again for another production of Enda Walsh's Mr. Man. It ran in Pagosa Springs, Colorado in late last year, right, Craig? Was it October, November?
Yeah, it ran October into November.
And you're going to run it again at the Boulder, Colorado Arts Week?
Yeah, so we're having a Boulder Arts Week, which is in its second year, at the Dairy Center for the Arts in Boulder, Colorado, this spring.
In late March, right?
Yeah, it's going to go March 23rd through April 3rd, I believe.
Okay. People tune in from all over the place, so you never know, we might have some people
from
Colorado listening in, or they can tell their friends to check it out. For people who aren't familiar maybe with the work of Enda Walsh, or in particular with Mr. Man, can you tell us a little bit about the play?
Oh, yeah. All right, here's my elevator speech. So the play is clearly titled Mr. Man. That's how I say it, by Enda Walsh. And it's about a man who is left alone inside a warehouse, and he recreates this one day which had a very strong effect on his life for the benefit of the audience who is witnessing. And it's almost reliving the most important day of his life, the day everything changed for him.
And so it's a one-man play, right? You're playing the lead role and you're the only person on stage, right?
Yes, I'm the only person who's live on stage. We have a handful of other actors, though, who played other parts. The play relies heavily on reel-to-reel tape recorders, old school, very theatrical looking, and each of those recorders harbors a voice of another actor, which are turned on, turned off throughout the entire production that I interact with. One of those being Academy Award winner Olympia Dukakis, who was fun to get in the studio with, and she recorded the role of Mammy, my mother. And the other actors are very talented, mostly Rutgers graduates, and a couple were actually from the Denver area who contributed to the project as well.
Very good.
Yeah.
So how did this production come about, Craig? What was your journey into it? And have you been a long fan of Enda Walsh's work?
I have been a fan of Enda's work. I did my undergraduate work at SUNY Purchase College and wasn't exactly sure what I was going to be doing there. I was interested in everything, and I was taking a lot of courses in the drama studies department, which is what I ended up getting my degree in, and I really enjoyed the challenging, mostly European works they would have us delve into. And one of the pieces I fell in love with was Crap's Last Tape by Samuel Beckett, and I don't know what it was. It was something about this man reflecting on his life and the nostalgia of it all, but also the variety of feelings and emotions that come from visiting something, the past, whether that's through pictures or sound or music. And so that play just always stuck with me. And it wasn't until several years later, I would say probably like mid-2000s, I ended up getting to read the first copy of Mr. Man, which was a clear response to Crap's Last Tape. And it fascinated me in so many ways. And I was like, yes, wow, a younger version of this same play in many ways, but in many ways very different and unique, and always been sitting in my mind. And then it was redone, restaged by Enda Walsh and Cillian Murphy, and I was like, I want to reinvest in this. Now I want to delve into it. So
wow, so it's evolved over quite a period of time.
Yeah, it really has.
Wow.
Probably over the course of almost 10 years at this point.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So, did you see Cillian Murphy play Mr. Man? Did you see him in the role?
I did, yeah. I went to St. Anne's and I sat in the front row.
Are you kidding me?
I was like, I want to see this. Yeah, and it was beautiful.
Right.
It was really wonderful.
So, I know from chatting to you, Craig, that you're part Irish. Was that any part of your interest in this as well? Can you talk to us a little bit about the specifics of it being by an Irish playwright, or, you know, the Irishness of the play?
Yeah, well, that's always been very fascinating to me, too. My grandmother's maiden name is Cleary, and clearly Irish. And I've always been fascinated with that part of my own family heritage, which I'm also really interested in general, whether that's Czech or Irish or a wee bit of Scottish, mm-hmm. and how that influences people, because that identity is something you can't escape. So I'm always interested in embracing it. And one of the most informative ways I've found of embracing my own heritage is to delve into projects that relate directly to it, whether that's by playwrights who are of that same cultural heritage or directors from specific countries who invite you to work on projects. It's just an excuse to delve deeper and to learn something new that you didn't know before.
So a play like Misterman, where you're the only person who's like live on stage and you're interacting then ostensibly with, you know, these tapes and voices, you know, presumably you do the recordings and that's about it in terms of like the interaction on stage, obviously, then. I mean, does that present challenges, Craig, or can you tell us a little bit about that process? And, you know, you're kind of there on your own for it, or?
I'm not there completely on my own. I have a stage manager who's there, and they have this entire, the most beautiful sound design and most beautiful lighting design, sound design by Matthew Bittner and lighting design by Elaine Wong, and it was directed by Melissa Furlett, and they designed such a beautiful piece, which is executed by our wonderful stage manager, Samuel Desmarais, and he is watching my performance with me, so it's almost like a dance, and things change in my own performance, and he's there interacting with me, and he's cueing things based on my interactions, and sometimes, you know, it'll give me a kick in the pants, and he'll cue something a little faster for me and keep me on my toes. So it is kind of like working with another performer. Those performances stay the same, technically. Their inflections are the same, but based on the audience and based on the mood of the evening or the afternoon, everything is actually very different. So I'm always learning new things every time.
So how did the audiences in Pagosa Springs react to the piece? I mean, I assume it hadn't, Misterman had not run there before and things like that. Are there any insights you can give to how people, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was the most amazing thing. We went out there on a wing and a prayer here, and luckily the Pagosa Springs Center for the Arts invested in us. They said, we believe in you, we believe in this project, we understand that it's risky, we're putting it in our October slot, which is, you know, where we like to put risky projects. We're not going to hold our breath, but we believe in this project. And it was one of their most successful fall shows they've ever had. And a lot of that had to do with the responses from the audience. We had people coming back to see the show 2-3 times. And initially, we only had talkbacks after the opening show, but the artistic director, Tim Moore, quickly instilled talkbacks after every single show, which quickly became my favorite part, because we actually started to learn more about the project and more about the production, hearing the audience response to it afterwards, than all of the time we had been spending, you know, creating something in table work and in rehearsal. So we created one thing, and it wasn't until we got into the talkbacks that you could actually hear and see the response that people were having to witnessing this man who comes in and warms your heart, and then in the end flips everything on its head, and you feel like you've been tricked or duped, or have you? Or is this just a human being who's 360 degrees on all things?
Were there particular questions or comments that came up in the talk back, Craig? Because, you know, Enda's work is, it's in that Samuel Beckett style. It's not the traditional kind of narrative arc or presentation of characters. He always kind of keeps us on our toes as audience members.
I know
expert on his work, but the ones I have seen. So I'm interested to hear how people reacted to that, or what came out in the talkback.
So this is a concern, because it's a very text-heavy show. And, well, A, the dialect we were worried about. You had to give some time for people's ears to attune to it. And then the text, I talk for about 90 minutes, and it's a whirlwind. I run on stage, and I'm on stage until the very end. I don't leave. And you always have to be concerned about that, especially with a one-man show. How do you keep it interesting? And Melissa did a beautiful job at creating a variety of levels and staging to break up the text and make it a little bit more palatable. But people's questions and concerns immediately turned into about mental health, actually, which was the most fascinating thing afterwards, is people knew this person. That's why a lot of people would stay for the talkbacks. We would have an audience of like 100, and we'd have 80 people stay for the talkback, which was amazing to me. But it's because they all knew somebody like this in some regard, whether that was somebody who was bipolar, schizophrenic, just depressed. They could all see the loneliness in this person and that constant reach for something, some kind of salvation from objects, from memories, from God even. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a beautiful experience.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, that's really what you're trying to achieve as an actor and for the playwright in terms of that universality or humanity that the audience members can identify, right? You know, that's a great outcome.
Yeah, people's often question was, aren't you exhausted? How can you play such a, well, these are judgmental words, which I don't use, but they would say that he was conniving or that he was evil or that he was just hurt. And, you know, my job is just to play the role, which I really thoroughly enjoy. It energizes me to bring something to life, only to see the energy and ideas and discussion that it instills in the audience about the play.
So in the talkback situations, I'd love to get a sense, Craig, of how much or how little, if at all, any sense of identity in terms of this being an Irish story. Was there linkage in terms of how the audience reacted to it being set in Ireland or about an Irish character in that sense?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the town of Pagosa Springs has a lot of transplants. They're mostly people who have retired and decided to make this their second home. So there was retired cops, Irish Catholic cops from the NYPD, who really appreciated this play just simply because it was an Irish play. They enjoyed the dialect, but they also had experienced people like this from Ireland who had mental lapses, who they would encounter on the beat, on the street. They're like, this is a real person. I can associate with it and appreciate it because of the cultural references, especially there's many Catholic references throughout the play, which also was a really firm connecting point amongst Irish Catholics who were seeing the play, but also the Irish or just the Catholic community that was there, which was also interesting. These are these things I didn't really think about just trying to serve the play. Here it's always fascinating to see what connections are made, what sparks happen. But we would have entire discussions about the brutality of Catholicism and whether that was really the problem with this young man, if that had somehow played into, or if that was just a modern thing that the audience was layering onto this.
And then it sounds like, though, I mean, not all of the audience would have had those references, be they Irish or Catholic, so then there obviously there's a wider appeal or there are connections that people can see who are not familiar with those references, right?
It was, and exactly, and there was, what was so wonderful is our audience would be so diverse, so we would have at least one Irish Catholic. Sometimes there was a couple people who were from Ireland, mm-hmm. and they became the representative, the cultural ambassador. So there was members of the audience that night who thought that Mammy was mean and probably treating him improperly and just a horrible person. And there would be those cultural ambassadors who'd say, no, that's just how a mother would speak to a child. That's just how people are to each other. It's no deeper than that. So it's interesting to see how people from other cultures would read into mm-hmm. this Irish Catholic story.
So, I mean, it strikes me, Craig, that you don't always get that opportunity to do the talkbacks on a consistent basis.
Never.
It's fantastic.
No, yes. And we are actually doing them after every single show now in Boulder, too,
as well,
because it was so interesting, so beneficial. And I learned so much about the play, and I learned more about culture through those talkbacks, listening to people respond and discuss. I love a good discussion. Mm-hmm. I love a good debate even.
So in terms of then the like more pragmatic things, you speak with an Irish accent.
Oh, I do. Don't make me do it though.
No, well, I won't make, not unless you really want to.
No.
But tell me about how you prepared for that, like more practically speaking, Craig.
Oh, well, more practically speaking. So we decided that it was going to be based on the text and based on the type of town it was, a very small, isolated town with references that it could possibly be near a seaside or some kind of fen or something. We were looking at Northern Ireland, so anywhere from Belfast up to Donegal, and trying to get the sound to be up there, which was much more specific than taking a sound from Southern Ireland or from Dublin, which I think most people are familiar with. for me, that was hard because sometimes for my ear, it took a long time to adjust the difference of Northern Ireland and Southern Scotland, because to my ear, they were getting very similar. But I watched a lot of television. This is Belfast, but there was this wonderful new show called The Fall.
Mm-hmm.
It was on, oh man, and Happy Valley, I think, was another one. So a lot of the BBC. But I would also, there's a wonderful thing called the IDEA, which is the International Language of English Archives, which is online, which has samples. And YouTube. YouTube was my best friend in finding samples of young men my age who are born and grew up in Northern Ireland, and listening to their canter, their pace, their speed, their dialect. And I would just listen and listen and take notes on their speech patterns.
So that was really important, you know, Craig, because there hasn't been always the most consistent history of people being really attentive to try and get that Irish accent, especially like a, you know, oftentimes people will do kind of a mid-Atlantic generic accent that could be Irish.
Yeah.
And often doesn't work, but it sounds like it was really something that was important to you in terms of really doing a specific accent very well.
Yeah, well, it was really an in for me, because I don't think if I had done that, I would have felt like I could be a part of the club, if
mm-hmm.
that makes sense. Because
mm-hmm.
I'm clearly an American. And, you know, I really want to do justice to the culture that I was choosing to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can honestly go to bed at night and sleep well unless you know that you put your best foot forward and
mm-hmm.
you really did your best to investigate and invest in these people. And I also have the fortune of trying to mimic and mock these other people whose voices are in the play. So I also got to try different voices and different canters and different speeds as well. But for Thomas, or Tomas, I really wanted to make him as specific as possible.
You know, as you say that, not to put down at all Cillian Murphy, because I happen to think he's one of the best Irish actors out there right now,
totally.
But he brought something different to the table. You know, it's just when you describe how you've described the research and you're engaging in that way with the dialect and with the culture and everything, because you're coming from an outsider perspective, you have to do a lot more work.
Yeah.
Whereas Cillian has that just because he's grown up there and stuff like that. So it's just a difference in terms of, I imagine, the process, not only of preparation, but just probably of execution a little bit as well.
And I think this actually goes back to a conversation we were having before we did this interview, where it goes to foreign actors coming in and doing American parts. When you are forced to delve into, especially through accent work, you have a responsibility that somebody who's from that country probably might not feel unless they're putting it on themselves. There's a different weight on your shoulders
mm-hmm.
to get it right. And so trying to recreate somebody who grew up in a small town, never left, completely isolated, I found that it's going to have less of an influence of English and American sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Very specific.
Well, listen, Craig, it's really fascinating to talk to you about this. Thanks for taking the time out to come in and have a chat to us. And best of luck at the Boulder Arts Festival. That's the right title for the run?
Boulder Arts Week.
Boulder Arts Week. Yeah. And so if anyone is tuning in from anywhere near Boulder, look out for in late March. So it'll run for about a week or 10 days?
Yeah, about 10 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'll have to come back and tell us more about the talkbacks after Boulder.
Sure. People can go to MrManTheShow.com for more information, and that's MisterManTheShow.com.
And that's Mr. Man, all one word, right?
Yes, yes.
And you're looking for support, Craig, in terms of if anyone wants to. Do you want to mention the Kickstarter campaign? You might as well, yeah.
I appreciate that. We have a Kickstarter campaign going on right now to help us meet some of our budgetary gap. And if people go to Kickstarter, they can also search Mr. Man, the title of the play, and it should pop right up. Or they can go to our website and go right to it as well.
That's great. And hopefully there are tentative plans or not to bring it to the New York area?
Yeah, so after, that's part of the idea of doing it in Boulder. We have a wonderful, we already have a good number of press coming, so we'll get some new press. Some of the funds that are earned from ticket sales will help us bring it back here to New York.
And when do you think that will happen, Craig?
Looking at the fall here.
Okay,
so
fall 2015.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, we'll have to have you back in. Best of luck with it. Thank you for sharing your experiences and telling us all about it. And break a leg, as they say.
Thank you so much, Miriam.
Thanks, Craig. So I'll start off by sharing one of Frank Corcoran's pieces, and then we will get to have our chat with him. I'm here at Luxman Ireland House with a man who is here to perform tomorrow at a performance at Christ and St. Stephen's Church at West 69th Street and Broadway at 3 p.m. The Irish composer, renowned composer Frank Corcoran. First of all, welcome to Luxman Ireland House, Frank, and to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. It's our pleasure to have you here with us.
I'm delighted to be with you today.
For the benefit of those who are not familiar with your work, can you tell us a little bit about your career as a composer and how you made your way to Germany and things like that?
I was born in Tipperary, very close to the Shannon, North Tip, very close to Lough Derg. And the sounds of my Tipperary childhood are still very deeply there in me. And the sounds of our farm and of our 100 free-running, you'd say nowadays, free-ranging pigs and 10 sows, and the sounds that they made at feeding time. I'd go down with my brothers and sisters, their mother ran the farm, with our buckets to feed this pig harmonic at 6 o'clock in the evening, and we had a huge range of sounds and of musical sounds. Even for me as a little lad of 10, I heard deep basses right up to the highest piccolos of the New York Philharmonic.
Was there a lot of music then more formally in the home? Were your parents musicians or anything like that?
There was very little music in the home. My father was a very good singer. He would sing occasionally. There was Gregorian chant in our local church in Burrisachane, County Tip, because the priest there, he was a madman, but he was a terrific madman on Gregorian chant. There was Shannos over in Galway, because Galway in those days, the early 50s, was light years away for us, and the Connemara Gaeltacht and so on. It was light years away from little Burrisachane and very little cars on the road. Although my father, who was the local engineer, he did have a car, so he was that bit more mobile than many of them. There was fiddles. There was local Cayley, music, of course. Now, this was before Shán Aríonna's revival or renaissance, as they like to say grandly today, of the present scene of Kyol Tradisiúint, of traditional music of Ireland. But you had the Cayley music, and I played a little button accordion with the local Cayley band. There was that. There was the Camellias in English language, not in Irish language. And I remember vividly Paddy Redden, who was our itinerant Camellias, I'll explain that, singer, ballad singers from the late 19th century in English language, on Monday at fair day going up the main street of Burzacane, and all the bawling cows and cattle and sheep and pigs and the whole lot there. And Paddy Redden with his Camellias, he could command the whole of North Tipperary with his Demosthenes art of singing, of bawling, really. Now, that's very, very deep stuff in me. The music of our nature in Tip, and the music of the Shannon, a mighty myth in itself, and the local, very humble Irish music of the early 50s.
I suppose it's the academic in me is pushing you. Where was that formalized then in terms of instruction, or where was your appetite whetted then in terms of meeting you as the composer today?
I had the great good fortune to go to St. Finian's College in Mullingar, which itself was a most dreadful place, I tell you, these early boarding schools for boys alone. But there was an inspiring priest there, Father Frank McNamara, who was a music graduate himself, fresh from Dublin. And he says, sit down there at that Blüthner piano. You're going to learn Beethoven. And I did. And I got very early on theory from him. Then I was in Maynooth, 1961 to 64. And I was the only pupil, private pupil, first pupil, really, for the National University of Ireland, of the professor of music there, Father Cathal O'Callaghan. We call him Charlie Chant. Then I went off to Rome, did some music there at the Pontifical Academy of Sacred Music in Rome. Then I came back, and then I went to both UCD and to Trinity. I wanted a foot in both camps. I wanted to dig with both feet. And then I went off to West Berlin, to Boris Blacher, who was one of the great composition teachers of the time. And then in the 70s, and I'm going to stop now, in the 70s I was a schools inspector all over the country in Ireland, the 70s. Went off to Berlin on an artist fellowship for 1980, and then slowly began my career as a professor of music in Germany, in Berlin, and then in Stuttgart, and then in Hamburg. Was over here then on a Fulbright professor, 1989 to 90, and got to know the American scene. I was teaching, but I was always a composer. I was composing my pieces. I was forming time. I was making sculptures of sound.
Can you recall your first compositions and what inspired you? What age were you, or where were you, or what were you doing?
I tried as a child, and first of all, we did have a piano at home. I don't forget that. I took the piano apart, and I put the piano together again. And I learned a lot from my little sonic imagination at the age of 10 or 8. And I did try to write pieces. It's very, very difficult for a composer. It's quite different to the development of a poet or an Irish painter, because I have to find form. And even to write 1 minute of music, 1 minute is an infinity. You have to get the form right. And of course, as James Joyce famously said, form is the relationship of the parts to each other and then to the whole.
When you're studying in Trinity and UCD, you're in the music department. You're very grounded then, not only and you're interested in the composition, but also then on the theoretical aspects.
Also, music, the whole academic thing, of course. I mean, it takes years for a composer to develop his or her style or fingerprint or something, or even to know what he wants to write. But I did, of course, write a million, what the Germans call style copies. And I still believe in that today. You have to be able to write a fugue like Mr. Bach. You've got to be able to write a piece of 3 minutes, 5 minutes, a slow movement like Beethoven. So copy, copy, copy from the great masters. The first work, also in Berlin, I mean, studies Blacher was terrific, because he said deep down, we don't want fascism in music. You have to develop your own style, and you must be responsible for that yourself, to say, that's me. But my first big work, really, was as I came back to Ireland, 1971, and I was so interested in two languages, English and Irish, apart from all Greek and Latin and so on. and I came across Frank O'Connor's beautiful little King's Lords and Commons, which is really his translations of medieval Irish epigrams. And this was wonderful stuff, Frank O'Connor. And I wrote for the very early arty singers nowadays. It's gone, but it was very good. The radio, the Irish Radio Chamber Choir, which was one of the top chamber choirs in the British Isles. And I wrote my 9 medieval Irish epigrams. And they're very short, and they're very good. They're now nearly 45 years old. One of them in the middle, for instance, and has got this short Japanese haiku quality. Total concision. One of them, I'll just say it for you here, it's a short little two-liner in English. Have you seen Hugh the Connacht King in the field? That's the question. And the answer is, all that we saw was his shadow under his shield. Well, that's terrific for a composer. Why? Because you've got the form there. So you got the question and you get the answer. And then this was part of my really opus one, and I still stand by it today.
So you probably hate this question, but if you'll indulge me, and I'm going to ask you a series of kind of interconnected questions in this sense. Who is the biggest influence on you as a composer in terms of the classic composer, the big names that the ordinary Joe and Josephine soap know their names?
Well, Joe and Josephine try, and particularly if they're in Salzburg in Austria and they're presented with Mozart chocolates, they try to understand Mozart. I tried also. I couldn't do it. He's too perfect. The real Mozart is hidden totally behind the sheen, the beautiful polish. Beethoven is much easier, rougher for everybody. He's the great Michelangelo of Western music. And I cannot talk now with you to say one is better than the other, or top, or big, or small. But Bach, for me, Bach is universal. Mm-hmm. He's towering above there. And he was a man who had to begin, let's say, his cantata for the next church event next Sunday. He would have to start on a Monday at this. By Tuesday, he'd have it written. And then he had to have the wife, all the kids, all his pupils, everybody going like mad, Wednesday to copy out the next composition. By Thursday, they had to have the orchestra and the singers to rehearse it. So Bach had to do this, plus teach boring Latin to reluctant kids in the St. Thomas School in Leipzig. And I'm sure he gave a couple of them the odd whack, maybe more than the odd whack, because Bach was a much more violent, much more temperamental man than our modern Holy Joe portrait of Bach.
In terms of Irish composers, can I ask you that kind of indulgent question as well? Who has influenced you the most, or who do you revere?
Very few, but Sean Arriaga, yes. In my 60s, Sean Arriaga was being slowly discovered, and of course he's iconic music for Saoirse and for, what's the other Irish film of the 60s?
Misha Era?
Misha Era was the big one. Oh, I hear the, you know, solo horns against the strings there for Misha Era. It was massive stuff, we thought, because Sean Arriaga, he had learned from Gustav Mahler, you know. Mm. So he influenced me as an example. He didn't influence my music at all. My music didn't want to be, I didn't want to be imitating anybody at all. And nowadays, you know, 45 years later, I know a lot of the big people of the 20th century, the giants, but there's very few. I lived in Hamburg and taught in the same faculty with the great George Ligeti. He's also now in America here, very big. Ligeti died a couple of years ago. And the Pole, a giant, Witold Lutosławski from Warsaw. So these are great, great men. They will be immortal. Their music will stay. Ligeti and Lutosławski. A Hungarian and a Pole, but not an Irishman.
So you started off there, Frank, by talking about the Irish influences on you as a child and on your music. But you've spent a long period of time in Germany. And I'd be interested to hear both about the influence of Germany and the culture of the people and your life there on your composition and your pursuits more generally. And then also maybe if you talk a little bit about the life of someone who seems very in touch with the sense of Irishness and very tuned to the history and culture and things like that, but who does so from the remove of living elsewhere. You know, we're interested in those kind of themes here at Glucksmann Ireland House in particular.
Well, good. From the very early 80s, I was living and working in Germany. But I always went back. every year. I mean, I did a lot of work for Irish Radio and the National Symphony Orchestra played a lot of my works. And I always kept in touch with the barometer and the thermometer of the little country. And I was always very close to old Kyol Tradishunta, the traditional music of the west and of the south of Kerry and so on, for its linearity, for its being melodic, one-line music. Ireland, the music was anti-European. It was anti-harmonic. It was anti what people think is the great received classical stuff. The Irish stuff was not. It was way out there on the western edge of Europe. And until Ireland, of course, joined the common market, it was hardly Europe at all. Mm-hmm. Your and my Ireland, certainly my Ireland in my youth, was a very interesting, different world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Germany, I was fascinated by the difference between the two peoples, of course, particularly 70s and 80s. And what the Irish had too much, the Germans had too little, often. And what the Germans had too much of, very often the Irish would have too little of. My first symphony was premiered in Vienna, in Mr. Mozart's city. Again, a different people, very different, the Austrians, in their own way. So now I live a lot of my time in Italy, different again.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose you've an Irish stew there. You've mm-hmm. got several influences, and I think that's good for a composer,
mm-hmm.
good for any artist. You've got to have a lot of influences, a lot of them contradictory, and they will kick up then the good stuff.
The piece of music we listened to there before we started speaking translates as Field of Sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Frank, can you tell me a little bit about that piece?
In the middle 90s, in Hamburg, I was professor there, and the culture, how would we say in American, the culture senator lady of the government of Hamburg. Hamburg is very interesting. It's both a city and it's a little federal state of its own. And she wanted a piece of music to commemorate. But how do you commemorate 50 years of liberation from Auschwitz? So she wanted me to write something there for four percussionists, a huge range of percussion. And I came up with, I didn't want to do it. I said, I'm not German, I'm not Jewish, but I said I'd have a go. So I came up with five fields of sorrow in the Irish Gurth und Rowen, in the German Trauerfelder. But these are very sharp miniatures, and of course they're about, with their gongs and their tam-tams and drums and so on, they're about suffering. So what we heard is the first of five Trauerfelder, Gurth und Rowen, fields of sorrow. And in its short 2.5 minutes, it has to get to the points of human suffering, not only in Auschwitz, but universal human suffering.
Tell us, Frank, a little bit about why you're here in New York specifically for the performance tomorrow.
Tomorrow is Sunday, February the 15th, and the North-South Consonants Orchestra, it's a string orchestra, is playing a new Frank Corcoran work. And I call it, in the Italian, quasi una storia, which means, in New Yorkese, quasi a story. And it's for 13 strings, which is a most wonderful color bank for any composer. You've got four first violins, you've got four seconds, you've got two violas, you've got two cellos, and you've got a bass. So you have a most wonderful, inside this story, quasi a story, which is being told by these only strings, you've got a wonderful palette, the full top of possibilities. You have choruses of strings working against each other, or a solo and the lot, or all the violins, or the two violas, beautiful sounds down there, against then dark bass and dark cellos. So tomorrow is the first performance of this under the conductor, Max Lifchitz. Wonderful man. He has done work of mine here in New York before, and all we want is a good audience there, because
mm-hmm.
this will be highly electrifying stuff.
It strikes me, Frank, as you talk, just the chat we're having here, and you describe tomorrow must be exciting to look forward to the performance in New York City and in accomplished company as well. It's a long way from a farm in North Tip, isn't it?
It's a very long way, and yet it's very close. Now, not my music nowadays is not the music of a traditional fiddler,
mm-hmm.
and yet it is. In the music of these 13 strings, of course, is also my childhood. Everything is there. And I'm not a woman, though I've had several children, but I didn't bear them myself. But tomorrow, of course, is the birth of a child. My work for 13 Strings is it's being birthed for the first time. It becomes alive as a living organism of sound and sounds.
So one last question, Frank, before I let you go and enjoy more of New York and we talk about the final piece that we will close out with. You know, and this says more probably about me and the circles I move in or the circles I grew up in, but you don't hear of so many people earning a living or, you know, professionally pursuing being a composer. What was it in your family background, do you think, that was, I mean, do you know other composers who came from your background?
Very few. I know a few Irish composers who did, because, of course, we were and still are an agricultural land. But in me, it had to come out in some shape or form. Now, I knew, and Blacher, my great teacher in West Berlin, he says, go back home. Do not earn your money. Don't try to earn your living from your composing. You could become a gardener or wash bottles of Guinness in a pub or become, doesn't matter what, but in the tiny little monastery of your mind, you will write your music. And you don't get them, I mean, if it's for television or film, okay, there's people there who have had great luck and have earned the big bucks. But my kind of music, of course, is quite different, and it's the music that will not earn the fortunes.
Mm-hmm.
Because art is art, and commerce is commerce.
Mm-hmm. So that's why you pursued then the other activities alongside that, but you've maintained, it's your true love, the passion of your life.
It's the meaning of my life on one level. We all have many levels, mm-hmm. but it's the one big, to shape sounds, to make sculptures out of time and out of noise.
Is it hard, Frank, when it strikes me, especially, you know, if you think about the Irish-American context as well and how, you know, the great interest in Irish music here, it strikes me that it might be more difficult to get attention than for the more classically inspired traditions and things like that. Could you comment on that a little bit?
There's at least two points here. One of them is, of course, that the Irish, we Irish, and there were a lot of Corcorans came over here too, we came from desperate poverty. We came from desperate Irish economic and psychological depression in the 19th century and in the 20th century. We had not had any access to continental art music, to the classical canon, let's say. And that's one point. Another point is, of course, that in America here itself, you've had, I think, a very bad development, not really a development of any kind of a receptivity in or an understanding of art music. Now, this could be art music from the 15th century or from Mr. Mozart or from the 21st century. So that's very difficult. And third and last point, of course, there is that in the world in general, since the First World War, contemporary music has had a very difficult time. That has all of kinds of other reasons we don't have to go into here. So I am lonely, but I have to be courageous. I fight. I've got to be the cool Cuchulainn of the tones. I write basically for myself and for you, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a nice place for us to finish, Frank. You might tell us a little bit about the piece of music we will close out with now, Quasi Una Missa, is that right?
Quasi Una Missa. I wrote it for West German Radio Cologne in 1999, and it won the, a couple of years later, said he humbly, it won a big Swedish prize for electronic music. It's made by the computer. The computer is my pencil. Quasi Una Missa has to do with over 2,000 years of Irish God utterances, God language. So I mix into my Irish stew with the computer. I painted in, I sculpted in all kinds of God utterances and religiosity from Abergeen, the Celtic god of poetry, right up through medieval Irish, right up through Bishop Berkeley, through James Joyce, and maybe Yeats is there, I've forgotten, and a little bit of Beckett, and there's an incredible mix. You don't have to know that at all. But the fourth little movement, which I call Agnus Dei, like the traditional movements of the Roman Catholic Mass. The fourth movement, a little short movement, is a sum up. And this shoves into this electrifying mix all kinds of things. At the beginning you have the keening women of the Aran Islands, the Queen. You'll hear Irish children with their little songs. You'll hear Purton Vale music, which was the lilting of the poor lads who had no money to have a whistle or a fiddle or an accordion, made with the mouth, Purton Vale. It's the music of your mouth. It shoves in all kinds of things into this little short last movement from Quasi Una Missa. And then at the end, of course, you have the voices coming again, just unaccompanied voices, with a little short God utterance by the great 9th century Irish philosopher, Johannes Scotus Erigena. You'd call him today Jack Scott, the Irishman, where he says, Deus est, God is, then God is not, and God is beyond these, the verb to be. And the last word is Deus est, Deus non est, Deus super est. God is beyond word, really. And it's plusquam is the last word in Latin, whatever that means, more than. And then the very last little syllable, of course, is very Joycean, I suppose, is puh.
It's lovely and fascinating to talk to you about this, Frank. Just to remind listeners, if you would like to hear and enjoy some of Frank's imagination, and it's really inspiring talking to you about this, tomorrow at Christ and St. Stephen's Church on West 69th and Broadway here in New York City at 3 p.m. I believe it's free to the public.
Very free.
Yeah. I'd highly recommend popping along to that for any of our listeners, and we'll have some information on it posted on our social media outlets as well, as we have done over the last few weeks. Frank, thank you for coming in. Fáilte arás.
Mahalat
agus beagtú arás arís, lecún of day.
Oh, lecún of day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mom. Molla. 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 Molla.
We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and the telephone number here at Washington News is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com, where they are also archived. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.